tonight to welcome Jim Fulton, who probably doesn't need an introduction to most of you here. You know of him from his service as Member of Parliament for the NDP for Skeena in the late 70s and throughout the 80s to the early 90s. And since then, since 1993, from his work as Executive Director of the David Suzuki Foundation. He is a graduate of Simon Fraser, but his father taught for many years in the medical faculty here at UBC, and both his children are students here at UBC, so we can forgive him the slip of going up the mountain for a little while. Climate chaos is a subject that should be of interest to us all. In my own field, archaeology, it's had very interesting consequences. Three or four places around the world, prehistoric bodies have popped out of melting glaciers, giving us insights onto folk as early as 4,000 years ago. But tonight, our speaker will talk about a much more serious matter, climate chaos. Could I introduce Jim Fulton? Thank you, Hector. I assume everybody can hear. It does sound like good acoustics. If I seem a little bit goofy during the evening, it's because it took me 14 hours to get back from Ottawa yesterday, thanks to the snow and our new non-competitive airline structure. I'm going to try and make the evening interesting. Parts of it is a bit of a grim topic, but everybody's got to think about these kind of things. So I thought I would take about 15 minutes to run through some of the science of climate change. What are some of the impacts we're already seeing? What are some of the impacts that some of the best scientists in the world are now suggesting are on the horizon if we carry on with business as usual? Then I'm going to give you about 15 or 20 minutes of a wonderful PowerPoint presentation that Paul has put together. Where'd Paul go? He's still here somewhere. Oh, he's fled. Oh, there is Paul right there. Because we have an excellent climate change team at the foundation who've been working very hard not only on Kyoto ratification, but on a whole range of solutions that I'll encourage you towards the end of the evening to take some of the challenges, both the nature challenge. There's a nice little brochure there I hope you all take, because there's something all of us can do to reduce our footprint generally, but also to deal directly with the issues of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere. And then I'll open it for questions, I think, until about 25 after 9, and then I understand there's some goodies that are going to be served in the lobby. Climate change isn't anything particularly new. The first person to do some publishing on this topic was Svante Arrhenius, a marvelous Swedish chemist who was actually a Nobel laureate, and he looked at what was happening in terms of the emissions from industrialization, and he predicted at that time, well over a century ago, that we were going to get global warming as a result of the amount of carbon dioxide that was starting to go into the atmosphere even at that time. The Earth's average surface temperature has stayed at around 14 degrees Celsius or 15 degrees Fahrenheit for millennia, and that's very much thanks to the gases that are there, water vapor, carbon dioxide. A series of gases are there that actually help to trap the heat here so that we're not a super cold planet. We actually have, as I say, quite a nice warm average surface temperature. But both the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was set up by the United Nations in 1988, and some of the more modern models by the Hadley Institute in the UK, are now predicting and suggesting that we'll see a temperature rise of perhaps as much as 6 degrees Celsius in the century, and the Hadley Center are now suggesting that could be as high as 8.8 or even 9 degrees Celsius. Carbon dioxide is responsible for about two-thirds of the warming. Methane is responsible for 20%. Halocarbons, things like chlorofluorocarbons, a very common chemical in the back of refrigerators and so on, are responsible for a staggering 14%, and nitrous oxides are responsible for about 6%, a lot of that from modern agriculture. So even with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projection of a 6 degree Celsius rise, that's a 41% increase over today's global average surface temperature. So you can see it's a staggering amount, and I know there's a few doctors here in the audience, and if you were to ask any of them, what does a 2 degree Celsius rise mean to a human? That means that you're getting a fairly significant fever. If you were to ask your GP the next time you're there, what does an 8 or 9 degree Celsius rise mean in the temperature when you stick the thermometer under your tongue, you're probably a goner. or you may actually already be gone. And I think it's important to reflect on these kinds of temperature rises that are now predicted with the modeling that's going on, particularly in light. We've already now had a significant increase in temperature in the atmosphere from what we've already put there. So by 1800, we started using significant amounts of coal in various areas of the world. And then in 1859, after oil was found drilling in Pennsylvania, a lot of it started to be used in furnaces first, kerosene and lamps, and then, of course, once vehicles started to be produced, oil really started to take off. I was born in 1950, and since that time, the use of coal on the planet has doubled. Many people think, oh, well, you know, we're starting to use less coal. Actually, the amount of coal being used continues to rise significantly. Oil since 1950 has gone up 8 times in terms of the amount that we're using on the planet, and gas has gone up 12 times. Burning coal releases about twice the amount per unit of energy as gas, and that's one of the reasons that a lot of organizations are pushing to get coal. At least one of the steps that you can take is to do some fuel switching, to move from coal back down the fossil fuel chain and try and at least reduce the amount of carbon dioxide per unit of energy that you're producing. Now, here's a great little quiz. I tried this first on my boss, David Suzuki, and he failed. So if you fail, don't be too surprised. But it's a good mental exercise, and I think it shows one of the core failures that's happening in our modern educational system, that's such a simple and obvious and important part of our information base is missing. So when you burn a liter of gas, I'm actually not metric, but I will stay metric because I see Daniel looking at me encouraging me to be metric this evening. A liter of gas weighs 0.7 kilograms. Everybody got that locked away? Right, it's less than a kilogram, 0.7 kilogram. When you burn that gas in your car, in your lawnmower, even if you splash it on the ground and light it and burn it, how much carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere? And I just want you to think about it for a moment, and I'll offer you 2 guesses that you might want to take. 0.2 of a kilogram, so when you burn the 0.7 kilogram, are you going to end up with less carbon dioxide? Or do you think you'd end up with 0.7 kilograms, that as you burn it, the same amount of carbon dioxide would go in the atmosphere? Everybody thinking about that now? Okay, let's do a quick test and see if we're all alert. How many people think that it's 0.2 of a kilogram that goes into the atmosphere? Well, there's a few. Okay, 0.7. Well, now you see, I lied. I didn't give you the real opportunity to answer. It's actually 2.5 kilograms of carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. It's counterintuitive. If you burn a piece of paper, what we've learned as humans, observing things being burned, they seem to go away. You burn a big pile of leaves, after they burn, they're gone. So you don't think about what's going up into the atmosphere. And this is a very important part of what I'm going to talk about this evening. So I want you to lock it away and remember that when you're burning coal or gas or oil or anything that's fossil-based, you're going to let off more in terms of weight of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere than with the fossil product you began with. In 1900, we were dumping 525 million tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Today, it's 7,000 million tons. I think you can see the rate of increase in utilization of these ancient preserved life forms. I lectured about a year ago at the Unitarian Church about why we should stop burning our ancestors in the atmosphere, because that's really what we're doing. There are very serious ethical questions to address about whether or not we should be burning our ancestors in the atmosphere. But a lot of people, including George Bush, of course the whole cabinet in the United States, they're all from the oil industry, Condoleezza Rice, George Bush, everybody is from the oil industry. And they often want to say the reason they and the U.S. Senate aren't interested in ratifying Kyoto is because of countries like China, that China is becoming this sort of runaway monster in terms of the amount of coal they're burning and carbon dioxide they're putting into the atmosphere. But I think as Canadians, we've got a special thing to remember. We are the largest per capita consumers of energy in the world. We Canadians, got to remember it, largest per capita consumers of energy in the world. Each of us, on average, releases into the atmosphere 28 times as much carbon dioxide per day as the average person in China. It's over a ton now for every man, woman, and child.
But not per square kilometer.
That's right. But carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for 50 to 200 years, and some of the more nefarious gases that I listed actually stay there a lot longer, and they're much more malignant in terms of what they do in terms of climate change. So the concentration of carbon dioxide is now about a third above normal, and it's higher than at any time in 20 million years. For a while, we were only back a couple of thousand, and then a couple of tens of thousands, and then more than 100,000 by studying ice cores. But we now realize that the concentrations we're at are now millions of years since we saw this level of carbon dioxide. So what happens with increased concentrations, you're probably wondering. Let me spend a few minutes just on impacts that we're able to see now. A lot of what you see coming out in science and nature and a lot of other publications are taking modeling and looking what happens with business as usual, Kyoto implementation, different scenarios as to what will happen now, 2030, 2050, and towards the end of the century. We've just gone through the warmest decade since written records began in 1860. And you sort of go, ho-hum, it didn't really happen here in Vancouver. But in a lot of areas of the world, it did. The World Health Organization study came out in January. More than 150,000 deaths can be directly allocated to last year's heat wave. 30,000 died in Europe. Earth's snow cover has decreased 10% since 1960. Glaciers are retreating worldwide. Spring and summer sea ice in the north has decreased by 15%, leading to a higher percentage of cub loss and weight loss in Canada's polar bears and other northern creatures. We've had a 40% decline in the thickness in Arctic ice, which is perhaps one of the most alarming. I think many of you are aware that the Ward Hunt ice shelf, more than 3,000 years old, collapsed in Canada's Arctic last year. The global average sea level is up 7 inches, something that not a lot of people are talking about, and there's certainly not enough research being done on it, although I'm sure the UBC Fisheries Center is going to get on it very quickly. The intensity and frequency of rain has increased in the higher latitudes of the northern hemisphere, but in some parts of the north and and much more widely in Asia and Africa, drought is spreading, and it's clearly related to the change in moisture in the atmosphere and in the soil. So many of you would ask, okay, so where can 6 billion tons of carbon that are coming from us, from burning fossil fuels, from cutting down forests, and from harming soil go? Well, the oceans hold about 40,000 billion tons of carbon. They're the largest single sink and reservoir on Earth, and they're now absorbing about an additional 2 billion tons a year. And plus, according to studies done here and in Europe, there's about 10,000 billion tons of methane hydrates. These are the frozen crystals that many of you will recall. There was a little snippet of coverage a couple of years ago when some fishermen on the west coast of Vancouver Island pulled up a big hunk of bubbling ice onto the deck of their boat, and they didn't know what it was. Nobody seemed to know, and it turned out it was methane hydrates. These crystalline structures of methane lie, in many cases, in quite shallow water, and that's one of the alarming prospects, because one molecule of methane is 20 times as much of what one might describe as an electric blanket. If carbon dioxide's a blanket and holding heat in, methane is 20 times that in terms of its capacity for radiating heat back into the atmosphere. Soils have 1,250 billion tons, so soils are also a massive reservoir. The atmosphere holds 750 billion tons, so it's not that big. So if you're thinking of where you're going to dump carbon, this is not a very intelligent approach to be dumping this amount of carbon into the very thin membrane above us. If you think of the Earth as a basketball and you take a piece of saran wrap, that's the thickness, the comparative thickness of the atmosphere to the size of the Earth. So it's a very tiny bit above us. The only reason we humans think it's so big is we look up and we just think it goes forever. It actually doesn't. You actually can't breathe very well at about 10,000 feet. Forests hold 250 billion tons, but we've taken down in the last few centuries about half of the world's original forest cover. So a lot of the sink of carbon that was originally assisting us in this grand experiment have already been taken down. So about half of what we put up right now is actually being taken back out either by the activities of the ocean in taking carbon dioxide back in or in various life forms through photosynthesis taking it back out of the atmosphere. So what does all this mean? Well, we've gone, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there was 280 parts per million in the atmosphere. Now we're at 372. This is where you get the figure that we've gone up about a third in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So let's look at fossil fuels for a moment. Plants are about 45% carbon, and photosynthesis operates at about a 1.7% efficiency. Plants are actually pretty smart if you think about it. You know, they stick their little hands out and they grab photons from the sun, and then they, you know, through all of these incredible processes, convert it into sugar and carbon and all kinds of amazing things, all kinds of things that we can't do. As my boss Suzuki often says, we're mobile compost heaps. We go around and burn up these amazing commodities of plant and animal carbohydrates and proteins. But what we burn up today is 422 times the net amount of carbon that's fixed today. It gives you some idea of the rate of utilization of carbon that we're involved in. We're doing it about 400 times as fast as nature could lay it down. And a very good study was done last year at Duke University, and I've often wondered if drivers could just sort of think about this for a moment. To get 1 gallon of gasoline took 89 metric tons of ancient plant matter. So if you could make a pile of 89 tons of grass and reeds and trees and all of that sort of thing, and that's what was required to convert over geologic time to just make that 1 gallon of gas when you stick it in the car. So if people had to pull into the local Chevron and say, you know, load 89 tons in the car and then you drive, you know, 2 inches, we might start getting the message through why we have to shift from fossil fuels as quickly as we can to renewable solar-based options. And of course, they're all there. This is the big issue that we have to face, is how do we make the shift? How do we get political structures and our societies in the whole of the world to switch fast enough to get off of fossils and onto renewables? So the good news is that the Earth receives 170,000 terawatts of solar energy per year. Massive amounts of energy is beating down on the sun all the time. And I should have converted this one into a quiz as to how many terawatts do we actually use. We use 13. So we get 170,000. So when you hear the oil industry always saying this, here's their latest, the latest rhythm and blues they're putting our way. We're running out of oil. This is a scary thing. There's just a few days left, so we got to just burn it up. Wind won't work. They say wind just won't work, even though countries like Denmark are 20% wind power, and lots of other countries are heading to that level. And then, of course, I'll tell you a little story. David and I met with the Prime Minister on Thursday, and, of course, he's still stuck in a bit of a rut, the carbon rut, and I'll tell you about that after we do the PowerPoint. But the reality is there is lots of solar energy coming to Earth, 170,000 terawatts, and we're using 13. Very important paradigm to keep in mind. So the future. Let me just spend a couple of minutes on the sort of grimmer list of what's coming, because our media are doing a phenomenally poor job in North America of talking to us. Media are supposed to have a conversation with us, and they're supposed to converse with academic institutions. We're supposed to have some controversy around these kinds of things, and it's just not in the media. It's not on the radio, it's not on TV, it's not in the newspapers, but it is in Europe. And I think we need to, all of us, because everyone who's here can influence these kinds of things, we have to influence the media to start truly and properly covering what the best scientists in the world are now warning us about. September of last year in Science, we were warned that the pH in the oceans is going from 8.3 to 8.1, which means we're heading to the lowest pH that we've had in the oceans for 300 million years. Right, Doctor? Yes. January the 4th in Nature, just last month, we were warned that we're going to lose by the middle of this century, if we continue burning fossil fuels at the rate that we're burning them, we're going to lose more than a million species. We'll lose about a quarter of the life forms on Earth over the next 50 years. You sort of have to say to yourself, gee, I didn't see that in the Vancouver Sun. All I saw was ads. Well, that's actually, it's true. We're not getting the dissemination of phenomenally important pieces of information. The Gulf Stream could shut down this century. So people say, well, gosh, what is that? What does it mean? Well, It's a big issue in England. It's a big issue throughout all of Northern Europe because a vast amount of the warming energy that they get in the wintertime comes on this giant conveyor belt that comes up from the Caribbean and from the equatorial part of the Atlantic, and it pumps all of this energy up, which keeps the temperatures in England and in Northern Europe 10 degrees Celsius higher than it would be without this giant pump. So how does the pump work? Well, the huge areas around Greenland act as the beginning of the pump, and you get this very cold, salty, dense water that sinks. So if you think about it like when you're sliding into the bathtub, pretend you're cold, dense, and salty. So you're sliding in, and then water goes along the bottom of the tub, and then it sort of slurps, at least if I get in the tub, it sloshes up at the other end, and then some of it will come back the other way. That's sort of how this giant pump works. Now what's happening, as I said to you a moment ago, the Ward Hunt ice shelf collapses and melts in the Arctic. 40% thinning in the Arctic ice. 10 to 15% less ice in the spring and summer in Canada's Arctic. So what's happening? Well, there's an awful lot of melting happening. And when it melts, this is all fresh water, and it's pouring out into the north, and it comes out of the whole Hudson Bay area, out of the Baffin Island area, and comes down in and around Greenland. And if you've ever wondered how much ice is there in Greenland, could that add to this? If the ice on Greenland also melts, the depth of the oceans in the world rises 20 feet. Let's not worry about 6 or 7 inches. Greenland has a massive reservoir of, of fresh water. In Europe, this is a very big issue. It should be a big issue here in North America. We're producing almost a third of the greenhouse gases in the world, we on this continent. Remember, we're the largest per capita consumers of energy in the world. We don't need to be, but we are. I'm going to talk about the things that we can do to reduce that. But if some of these giant systems that scientists are now starting to look at, and they're saying the pump is already being affected. It's not that they're thinking the pump might be affected. The pump is being affected. And that's one of the most significant issues that I think is going to continue to cause Europe to move at good speed. So we have to worry about this thermohaline circulation. The other area of concern I think we have to have is what's happening in the Antarctic. People have been noticing, scientists have been noticing a decline in the number of penguins. The area around James Ross Island, my first two names, so I always remember that one. It's easy to remember when you have to write it down. All of the ice around it has completely melted for the first time in tens of thousands of years. And again, if just the West Antarctic ice shelf, which is now starting to crumble and has that huge crack, at least the Globe and Mail ran a picture of the crack. They didn't explain what it was, but they let us all know there was a crack. If that melts, again, that's another 20 feet the oceans would rise. So these are vast, important reservoirs, and if they melt, they dramatically change all of the major cities around the world, because about 2 billion of us live in river estuaries. We live in a river estuary. Vancouver's a river estuary city. You look around the world, most of the large cities of the world are built at, on, near, or around estuaries. And the largest migration of people in the history of the world are moving from the interior of continents out to the coastlines. So it's a very bad time to be messing around with something that might affect either estuaries, freshwater, or nearshore cities. However, you know, as I go through this grim catalog, there are some very big players who are now starting to step up to bat. Munich Re and a group of the biggest reinsurers in the world warn that weather-related natural disasters have gone from $50 billion in the whole of the 1960s. So that's a huge amount of money. And of course, this is just for countries and for cities and for people that carry insurance. Let's remember, over 80% of the people in the world don't have any insurance or even access to the kinds of economies that we're talking about. But it was $50 billion in the 60s. That leapt to $500 billion in the 1990s. These are settlement payouts related to weather-related natural disasters. And they're very carefully now studying extreme weather systems, and they're starting to do some very powerful and important political work. But figures are just out 2 days ago. For 2003, it leapt to $60 billion. So it's continuing to rise very steeply. And the reinsurance industry have now warned that a continued rise at this rate would simply bankrupt the existing world economy by 2065. But again, these are things that are reported if you go out and you search these issues down, but these are things that are not part of our conventional, everyday conversations, and I think we have to work very hard to make them so. So, the Kyoto Protocol, a very important and wise piece of work done by a lot of world leaders. It requires 55 countries producing 55% of the emissions to get it to trigger, to get it to kick into gear. And that's why there's this great concern about the U.S. saying no, they won't be involved, and also the great expectation that President Putin will, in fact, move and get Russia to sign. If Russia signs, the protocol which Canada has ratified kicks into gear, and a lot of the very important mechanisms start to come into play. A teeny bit of history before I go to the PowerPoint. The United Nations established the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in 1988. In that same year, there was a very important meeting called the Toronto Atmospheric Conference, and scientists from around the world there met, and with the best of the science that they could mobilize, called for 20% cuts from 1988 levels by 2005. So over that period of time, that's what they called for. Less than 2 years later, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the largest body of scientists to ever work on a single meteorological issue in the world, called for immediate cuts of 60%. That's what is required to stabilize the atmosphere. But they realized politically, because of the amount of investment that there is in a fossil fuel infrastructure, that they had to go to the drawing boards and look at how do you actually get the movement of rising emissions to at least start to cap off and become declining emissions, a very important political process in a complex world such as where we live. They warned at that time, this is 13 years ago, they warned that 80 to 90% cuts below 1990 levels. 1990 is the threshold for all evaluations of national emissions, but an 80 to 90% cut is necessary to stabilize the atmosphere. An important parallel fact I want you to remember from this evening is that 95% of the fossil fuels burned in the world are burned in the north. Only 5% are burned in the south. So again, it's why if you want to think of it, the average Canadian burns 28 times the amount of carbon dioxide as someone in China. There's a very important reason why the north has to move and move very rapidly. Canada's emissions in terms of the world are 2%, the same as the UK, even though there's twice as many people in the UK. And again, something worth remembering, our emissions, Canada, is roughly the same as Africa. Canada's emissions are roughly the same as the entire continent of Africa. I mean, if that doesn't sort of dumbfound you and say, Godfrey, what are we doing? You know, is the country on fire? To me, it's one of the most telling statistics of all. There are a growing number of studies that show that we can get to 80% reductions by 2030 using existing cost-effective energy-efficient technologies. So, you know, when people throw up their hands and say, oh, no, we can't do anything until 2050 or 60, remind them that there is good science-based work out there that shows that what we already have technologically on the shelf can get us to where we need to go. In 1992 in Rio, promises were made, the largest gathering of leaders in the history of the world, and promises were made to stabilize at 1990 levels by 2000. That was sort of, again, one of my political nightmares. I was up standing clapping for Brian Mulroney because on behalf of Canada, he said, we're going to do it. And I thought, good grief, you know, Mulroney, the guy from Iron Ore, he's come alive, he's alert, he understands what's going on. But of course, since that time, our emissions have actually gone up almost 25%. So in 1992, this is an interesting little anecdote because I reminded the Prime Minister of this on Thursday in Ottawa when I met with him about what position he's now going to take on Kyoto. We worked on a report together for 4 years, a series of reports, the largest parliamentary report that had ever been done on the atmosphere. We called for 20% cuts from 1990 levels by 2005. And as you'll see, we adopted the reference point of the Toronto Atmospheric Conference that climate change, climate chaos, is second only in terms of a threat to all-out nuclear war. That's how serious climate change is becoming. And that was, I reminded the Prime Minister of that, and he harumphed a bit, but he does remember it, and I can assure you I'm going to remind him of it a lot now that he's been Prime Minister for a week. So in 1997 in Kyoto, again, some great work was done, and countries that were there targeted 5% reductions by 2010, with Canada promising 25%.
There's a lot of background static as well.
Hello? How's that? Okay. I'm going to go to the slides. Let me just finish here. So, where are we? Well, we're more than 20% above our 1990 levels. Sweden has now committed to 60% cuts along with the UK by 2050. So, when people are sort of sniveling, when Canadians snivel about, it's going to be so hard for us to make our 5% cuts, let's remember that they're are people out there who are much more serious. How about DuPont? They met, pulled all their scientific staff together and said, okay, we want to reduce by 10%. DuPont found that since 1990, they reduced their greenhouse gas emissions by 65% and made money. British Petroleum pledged in 1998 to their shareholders to reduce greenhouse gases by 10% by 2010. They found in 3 years they made it beyond the target and made $650 million in profit doing it. So big corporations, when they actually ask their own internal staff and scientific support to move on climate change, to move on greenhouse gases, they find that it's rather easy to do and in most cases fairly profitable. Well, what about an institution like UBC? I was interested in knowing I was going to speak here tonight. Well, what's UBC doing? Well, I actually found if you look through the curriculum, there's not enough. It's less than 0.25% of the curriculum that's available that has something that at least my naked eye could identify as being relevant to climate change solutions, and yet it should be, I think it should be at least 10 or 20% of required curriculum for every student in the whole country. Because if they're not focused on this, they're not going to be able to be part of the solution. But UBC, dear Martha, has signed a $35 million contract to retrofit 288 buildings here on the campus, which, and here's the good things, that's going to save 20% of the energy required here on campus, 40% of the water, and it's going to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 15,000 tons a year, which is a pretty significant reduction for a campus of this size with 40,000 students. But what are other people doing? Toronto cut their greenhouse gases by 67% since 1990 by capturing methane. We're doing a bit of that in Vancouver, but Toronto's really gone at full hog. Big building retrofits and lighting, that's where they've done it. So it's efficiency and conservation, two-thirds, 67% cuts. So where's the problem in making the shift from fossils to renewables? Well, here's an example, not a quiz question, but an important one to think about. A 1912 Model T Ford got, guess how much per gallon? Well, you're saying, oh, another one of these stupid quiz questions. 35 miles per gallon in 1912. The entire average fleet efficiency for Ford in 2004 is lower than that. They only have one vehicle for sale that gets 35 miles to the gallon. So you say to yourself, gosh, in 100 years, we can't get any more fuel efficiency. The Union of Concerned Scientists went and bought a Ford and put $1,000 worth of parts available off the shelf on it and doubled its fuel efficiency. So you say to yourself, oh, what's going on here? Could there be some kind of collusion between the oil companies and the auto manufacturers to burn more gas? I would never suggest such a thing. But the fact of the matter is, the Union of Concerned Scientists identified technologies that are available off the shelf to quadruple, not double, not triple, to quadruple the amount of mileage that you can get. And even if you look at a Prius, for example, you get 150% more fuel efficiency than your average Ford. So you have to say to yourself, there's something going on here. This reminds me of one of Churchill's great quotes. People and nations behave wisely once they've exhausted all other alternatives. And I think we've probably done that with the oil industry. One last quiz question, and then I'm going... Have we gone haywire again? How's that? Huh? Okay, one last quiz. One last quiz. I'm glad to see Peter. Peter Nemetz and I have known each other a long time, and he's been teaching here at UBC a long time. And I sacked him on this question, so I want to see if you guys get it. What country is the largest provider of oil to the United States? Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Algeria, Canada. It's quite amazing, isn't it? And that's part of the reason that we have such a big job to do, is the major point source for that oil for the United States has been identified by the United States as being our tar sands. And to make a barrel of oil, to stick it in the pipeline, to send it to the United States, we have to burn at Fort McMurray another barrel of oil to get the barrel out of the ground. So instead of just releasing 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide, burning it in your 1,000-horsepower Cadillac in Texas, we have to let 2,000 pounds of carbon dioxide go into the atmosphere. It's a completely bad experiment gone wrong, and it's certainly one of the things in the next couple of years our foundation will be taking head on, is how to keep the tar sands tar. A wonderful UBC student's going to come up and, and is going to run this machine, because I am a complete Luddite. Now, I'll try and go through it fairly fast so that we can have time for questions. This runs through what's happening with Kyoto, and I'll try and let most of it speak for itself. So, Katie, let's go. Two. Oh, you've already gone two. Three. Oh, no, go back one. Oh, no, that's it. Okay, now I know where I am. Oh, very good. Ah, fabulous. This is fabulous. Sir David King, who's the chief scientific advisor to Tony Blair, said this a little over a month ago. It got a teeny bit of coverage in Canada, but it's certainly something that's being talked about much more widely in Europe, as Europeans have a much more serious dialogue about terrorism and the roots of terrorism. And this comparison to climate change is absolutely valid and completely correct. Because if you look at the numbers that could start to occur as early as 2020 with vast numbers of refugees, and I'm talking not tens of thousands, I'm talking tens of millions of environmental refugees having to move in relation to drought, having to move in relation to sea rise, having to move in relation to mudslides and hurricanes and extreme weather events. So I certainly doff my hat to David King for having gone public on this. The next one down, I think, is equally as worthy of doffing one's hat to. This is the largest global gathering of business leaders that occurs each year, the one in Davos, the World Economic Forum, and they have recognized that this is the greatest challenge facing the world. The third one is the quote I referred to earlier, that humanity is conducting an unintended, uncontrolled, globally pervasive experiment whose consequences could be second only to a global nuclear war, just as true now as it was in 1988. Now, this next one is the famous hockey stick. This is the one we should all be familiar with. Relatively flat and constant levels of carbon dioxide. Now we know, going back, that hockey stick goes 20 million years to your left. And we're now rising in a very short period of time to a virtually vertical in geologic time rise in carbon dioxide. Temperature change. Now, I think this is a fancy one, right? Ah, you'll see at the bottom, the time is changing very fast, and it gives you an idea of where you're starting to see the really significant rise in global temperature. And you'll see where we live in the north, and particularly as you go further north, north of 60, you start getting really significant and nasty temperature rise, which is going to have a particularly nasty warming effect, as you can see over in Greenland and in Canada's Arctic. This is just, it gives you a taste of 10 years of what the scientific community have been warning us about. The IPCC's first report is the first quote there. The second one was the one that was contested first by George Bush, saying, oh, well, you know, maybe it's ducks or something that's causing the atmosphere to get warmer. It certainly can't be oil. But it's quite clear that it's our hand. It's our burning of carbon dioxide, harming to the soil, other gases that's causing climate to start to change. The third assessment report, again, even stronger. And then, of course, President Bush appointed a blue ribbon panel of people he was quite sure were going to say climate change is nothing to worry about. And, of course, they came to the unanimous view that, of course, climate change is real and George Bush should do something about it. And maybe he will. Climate change impacts global. This just gives you a sense of where some of the big areas of concern are. Species loss, that's the big publication that just came out in Science. Human settlements, there are some entire countries that by 2020 will have to be evacuated. People have to move somewhere else. The number of people in the WHO December report from last year. And also the fact that climate change is fundamentally inequitable. It is the poorest people in the world that are going to take by far the heaviest hit. People, even in Europe, the 30,000 that died last year, people in many developed countries can escape from these long periods of extreme heat because of things like air conditioning, which of course are burning more fossil fuels and pumping it up. It's people in the poorer areas of the world that will be hurt the most if we don't turn this around. Direct economic losses. This is information from the biggest insurers in the world, showing you the rate of rise since the 60s in payouts for extreme weather-related events. It's from R.E. Suisse. Would they adjust it? Yes, I'm sure they would. Human exposure to malaria. I think this one, again, gives you a bit of an idea of how gigantic the increase in numbers of people. More than 80 million a year new exposures will occur as the capacity for this vector-borne disease to move into new areas. We're just starting to be familiar in Canada with diseases like dengue and West Nile that are moving because of the increasing habitat opportunities for mosquitoes. Loss of species. This is taken directly from last month's Nature. It's certainly something you should go onto the internet and read if you haven't read it yet. It, I think, gives you a real sense of the challenge that we face to get ourselves and our municipalities and our provinces and governments to move very quickly to shift, not just on efficiency and conservation. We can make huge gains there, each of us individually. Even a roll of duct tape can reduce your heating costs by 25% by just putting it around your doors and windows in most homes in Canada. And the big challenge is to move to renewables. This is the breakup of the Larsen B ice shelf. We'll just let it run a couple of times so you get a sense of what's happening. Now, this is taken from the Canadian satellite with NASA. And, of course, it has that kind of melting and temperature shifting will affect all of the biota in those areas. So where seals and penguins had been feeding, all of that starts to change as you have more open water. And, of course, more open water allows more heat to be absorbed in those areas, causing more melting. And you get into all kinds of positive feedbacks. Of course, those in Canada's north, David Suzuki was up in the north last summer and two summers before that, interviewing elders. Elders and communities are extraordinarily important reservoirs of information for all of us. And by going and interviewing elder Inuit and Dene people, David managed to gather materials for the program that he did on what they're simply observing, not only in terms of there being butterflies and birds they've never seen before, salmon in the Mackenzie, all kinds of extraordinary losses are also occurring at the same time for creatures that can't operate in either a warmer or varied habitat. These are some of the issues that we need to think of in terms of Canada. In the 30s and 40s, there were virtually no kids in Canada who were diagnosed with asthma. Work we've been doing with Dr. David Bates, the retired dean of medicine from here at UBC, now about 20% of the kids that are attending school in Canada are either using puffers or are diagnosed with asthma. And of course, asthma is not just related to climate change, it's related to the particulate matter that comes from burning fossil fuels. And the California Air Resources Board have done a very significant amount of work on that. So that lists some of the things I spoke about earlier. And I popped this one in especially for Daniel Pauly. This gives you a sense of where the current salmon habitat is for our anadromous stocks coming out all along the coast of BC and up into Alaska. And now you can see what happens with 2 times carbon dioxide, which is where we're heading. Salmon habitat for much of the year, this one shows you July, shows you that basically salmon will be withdrawing practically up into the Beaufort to find habitat. This is a projected increase in the number of hot days. Now, in some cities, you see, you run your eye down and you say, well, for Victoria, it's not that bad. But if you look at what happens in cities like Winnipeg, or London, or Toronto, you're looking at the number of days greater than 30 degrees Celsius. Greater than 30 degrees Celsius. And Winnipeg will have more than 70. I mean, it read into that whether you're raising poultry, or beef, or organic cereal grains. Virtually anything in the agricultural world will be negatively impacted by the declining availability of moisture in the soil. This is mortality increase during high pollution days. We did some work 5 years ago using studies done by the Government of Canada and did a great deal of work with the doctors here in BC, in Ontario, and in Quebec. We ultimately got more than 20,000 doctors working with us, putting up posters in their offices of little kids flying kites, saying this is about all we should be putting in the air, trying to get parents to connect that when they drove up in their big SUV with the kid with a puffer not able to breathe and they come into the doctor's office saying, you know, I don't know what to do with little Johnny. We have to start helping people to discern the source of a lot of these issues. And certainly the burning of fossil fuels in cities where 80% of Canadians live is something we have to move away from fairly quickly. I mean, even just driving a Prius or even having 4 people in your car, there's all kinds of things we can do. And in some of the materials I've handed out, you'll see where a lot of these solutions are to particularly start bringing this mortality down. But there's 16,000 Canadians. This is more Canadians are dying from the crap coming out of tailpipes than are dying from car accidents. And yet you never see that in the paper. You never see the auto manufacturers talking about it. But it's a significant and real epidemiological risk factor. Increased risk of drought on the prairies. This one's actually a little bit hard to read. But if you look along the bottom, the length of dry spell days in Central North America, and look at the blue by 2070, so length of dry spell days getting up to 30, and then up the left axis, the return period in terms of the number of years, you'll see that farmers are now having to look at very long periods of drought coming more often. Because sometimes you can sort of dodge the bullet if you're a farmer. You can, you know, if you have a deeply rooted crop like alfalfa or something like that, you might make it through. But these are very worrisome signs of what's coming, not only for the Palliser Triangle, but for whole regions of Canada's prairies. Global per capita emissions, I referred to this earlier. You can see the good old pig Canada over there with the U.S. Dumping it out there. We're there at 16, the U.S. are there at 18. But if you look over there at India on the left, if all people in the world, if it was allocated on a per capita basis at around a ton, that's where the world is at, since we're dumping out between 6,000 and 7,000 billion tons into the atmosphere. I was in Parliament on Thursday. This is how I felt. I'll just let you read it. Oh, the picture's pretty bleak, gentlemen. The world's climates are changing, the mammals are taking over, and we all have a brain about the size of a walnut. Now, I'll run quickly through the Kyoto Protocol, signed in 97. It provides binding targets and an enforcement system. It only calls on countries to go down 5%,
below 1990 levels by 2010. And the reality is that still means we're going to have a 30% increase in greenhouse gas emissions as a planet. But the important thing about Kyoto, as I said earlier, it's the dynamic. We have to start changing the direction of the increases so we can actually get to the 80 to 90% reductions that we'll need for certainly for our children and grandchildren. Russian ratification is required, and there's ongoing negotiations. Canada's emissions profile, I'll just spend a minute on that. About a third, about 35% of our emissions are from trucks, cars, and jets. Aircraft are now putting about 10% of the greenhouse gases into the atmosphere worldwide. It's a gigantic issue, and it's one that we'll that we're going to have to face as a planet sooner rather than later. You'll see that the production of gas and oil is a very significant part of this for Canada, and then there's industry and residential. And on both industry and residential, we can do a lot. With efficiency and conservation, we can get 60, 70, 80% reductions in greenhouse gas just with technologies that we have. And as I said, stuff as simple as duct tape is part of the solution to our emissions. Canadian Emissions Plan, this is what's been negotiated. This is what Ralph Klein and Gordon Campbell and everybody are always going squawk, squawk, squawk about. There isn't a good enough plan. Obviously, we need a better plan because there is a gap between what we've committed which is Canada's target of 570 megatons. So we have a very significant gap in terms of hundreds of megatons that we have to reduce to hit our target by 2012. And we can easily make it. If you bump into anybody on the street or at home or in the pub or wherever you go to talk to people, and they say, oh, we can never make the Kyoto Plan. You better tell them to get on the internet, have a look at a few of these websites as to what the solutions are, because there's plenty of solutions, but it requires a much greater ethos from all of us. We've got to get a lot more excited about getting out there and doing those three things: renewables, efficiency, and conservation. We have to wreck the economic climate for big oil. Climate Protection Plus. Avoiding the most serious consequences of climate change has all kinds of co-benefits. As we do a lot of the things that are necessary to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we get a lot of great things. Personally, reduced energy costs, job creation, urban renewal, all kinds of good things will come from us doing these things. So what about in your home? Natural Resources Canada are providing a grant. PowerSmart with BC Hydro are doing things. If you've got a 15 or 20-year-old, I see my mom sitting there. I'm glad I got her to get rid of an old fridge she had. And by doing that, there are fridges now that are 90% better in terms of the amount of power that they use. So you can get huge personal savings and great environmental savings by when you're buying something, buy the most energy-friendly car or fridge or whatever you possibly can. Conduct an energy audit and a retrofit. Even if you're in a relatively new place or a place that's been done, you might be quite surprised about the number of smart things that you can do to reduce the amount of energy that you're using and the amount of energy that's wasted. So look for Energy Star on products. And certainly one of the things we're doing as a foundation is pushing provincial and federal regulators to bring in much stricter and much more conservation and efficiency-oriented regulations so that we get better products into people's hands and into their homes. Transportation, I'm going to get everybody to take the Nature Challenge, the smaller form that I handed out. I want you to all take it because it's actually a lot of fun. There's 10 things you can do in there. Just do three in the next 12 months. And in terms of transportation, it can actually be the most fun in terms of just shifting your usual mode of transportation. If Dick and Verna are going to go to the store, instead of just doing that, they phone a couple of other people and take four people in the car. You go and do these kinds of things. And just by doing that, take two other people with you. When you're doing something, you reduce your greenhouse gas emissions in half just by making a phone call, which doesn't cost anything in terms of energy. Making fuel efficiency a priority, extremely important. And, I mean, a good thing here at UBC, every student automatically gets a bus pass. They pay for it whether they use it or not. These are smart things that can be done on a large scale to reduce greenhouse gas output. Now, here's the kind of crap, though, at the political level, everybody's been fighting now for about 30 years. This is one of those great Lee Iacocca quotes. If the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency does not suspend the catalytic converter rule, it will cause Ford to shut down and would result in, one, the reduction of gross national product by $17 billion, increased unemployment of 800,000, and decreased tax receipts of $5 billion at all levels of government so that some local governments would become insolvent. I guess everybody knows the U.S. economy actually benefited, and there were health benefits. But it's these kinds of people and these kinds of statements that scare a lot of people. They say, oh, gosh, we can't do any of these sort of things. You know, what kind of a Canada would we be living in? We'd all be back in caves and, you know, it'd be horrible. We can't do that. It's very important to prepare yourself for the kind of false information that will soon again be circulating as we go to implement Kyoto. Solutions for power producers, there's lots of them. And PowerSmart are doing some of them here in BC, but there's a huge other range of opportunities out there that that need to be implemented, including things, as Toronto has done, capture more of the methane. There's all kinds of methane still escaping, both from our bad landfill and bad sewage practices here in BC. So solutions for government. You'll love that little House of Commons over on the right side. I don't know if you can see the Mountie riding the camel. That was my idea. I've always liked that ad because the people that work inside there, they need to, and we ran this right in the paper in Ottawa, and actually a lot of them were wondering whether or not it was a real photo. That tells you even more. So a lot of us forget, the federal government is the largest employer in this country. It's one of the largest energy consumers. And there's a huge amount that the federal government can do, and there's a lot that all of us can do. Having wrestled away 15 years of my life going back and forth to Ottawa and getting elected, there is something we can all do, and there's going to be a federal election in May, and I don't think BC should send anybody to Ottawa, whether they're Liberal or NDP or Bloc or Conservative Reform or whatever that alliance is soon to be called, unless climate change is at least number one or two. And if they can't at least explain the issue. We shouldn't be sending them to the House of Commons. I watched the place on Thursday, and it was bad when I was there, but we've allowed the average IQ level of people we're sending to Ottawa to dip a little low. And I think we have to ask them directly. They got to at least have the IQ of drying paint or room temperature or something. And on this issue, it's just so important because governments can do a gigantic amount with regulations. In 1982, I was there and voted with all members of the House, and we passed the Canadian Federal Vehicle Fleet Efficiency Standards. There have been six prime ministers since then. That passed through Parliament, passed through the Senate, and it was shipped over to the Governor General. Six prime ministers in a row have stopped it from becoming law. Pierre Trudeau, John Turner, who came next? Brian Mulroney, Kim Campbell, Jean Chrétien. And I reminded Paul Martin of this, that it's sitting there waiting to be implemented. And all it is a fleet efficiency regulation. But the oil industry and the vehicle companies in Canada are so strong, for 22 years, they've kept laws that were democratically passed in this country from being implemented, and that's why a 1912 Model T gets a higher fleet of a higher level of efficiency than any car you can buy right now. And there's no reason for it. Cars can be made right now that can get over 100 miles to the gallon. The technology's with us, but you require governments that have cojones to make these things happen. Further steps to reaching Kyoto. More domestic reductions are possible through energy efficiency policies, and some cities are doing great work on this. We just released a big report on sprawl in Toronto, and Vancouver's got the GVRD has a big problem with sprawl. We pay more for roads, more for power, more for cars, more for buses, more for everything when we allow sprawl. And we have to get more people involved municipally who understand that we have to start living up, not out. It's a fairly simple paradigm, but it's one that is simply not being practiced well. It's amazing. The city of Calgary is now larger than New York City. And you sort of have to say to yourself, well, why? Well, because we've got really bad planning. And now they're talking about getting Canada to pay for the Circle Road around Calgary so that they can now expand and have more sprawl outside of Calgary, already bigger than New York City. I mean, these are not bright people. Maybe I'll go run in Calgary. And we have to move stuff off of rubber and onto rail. Steel is the way you move heavy stuff. People figured this out when John A. MacDonald was pounding the spikes into the ground. You move heavy stuff on steel, and you move light stuff on rubber. Hopefully we can start getting those sort of things through. Success stories. This is really... I should actually be spending more time in this. I wanted to get a lot of grim stuff into you to make sure that you're all highly motivated to take the nature challenge and to do other stuff. But there is all kinds of success out there. BP, IBM, Interface, Toyota, Dofasco, the TD Center in Toronto, the Vancouver Airport here. Vancouver, simple things like the LED traffic lights. I mean, it's saving thousands and thousands of dollars a day by simply changing the lights. Calgary, they've got the Ride the Wind train. It's a good thing. Regina. There's all kinds of great stuff going on, and you just need to get people mobilized, in some cases just to ask different levels of government to start doing these things, and to get the business community involved. The business leaders in the world understand this is the number one issue of the century, and it's really just being held back by the oil patch. And the reason for this is not rocket science. The average oil company in the world last year was making more than 20% return on capital. This is not rocket science. They don't want to give up their position. They don't want to give up their share. So we as people are just going to have to push them aside and say, no, you know, you've had your run. We liked your product. It's like tobacco. We don't want it anymore. We want clean, renewable energy. Remember, 170,000 terawatts a year are coming to us from the sun. We're only using 13 solar. I mean, all of the big cycles of solar, hydro is solar. I mean, wind is solar, tidal is solar. All of these opportunities are solar, and it's the future for us and for humanity. The next one is just our climate change program. We have a wonderful team at the foundation. Anybody who wants information or want to get... Oh, of course, Paul's still here. I shouldn't be inviting everybody down. But we have a wonderful team who work mostly on... national regulatory, national solutions, but they do fabulous work. And David, of course, does a huge amount of work for us here and around the world. He's in Kuala Lumpur right now at the Millennium Assessment Process, and climate is one of the key issues that David is working very hard on to keep people moving forward on this particular file. So what can you do? I didn't know this slide was in there. I didn't know the slide was in there. If you don't belong to the foundation, you will before you leave, because the doors are going to be bolted. I'm just kidding, of course. But it's easy to get to. You can remember his name, www.davidsuzuki.org. There's newsletters that have been handed out. There's a nature challenge. If there isn't a card there for you, go online and sign on. It's kind of exciting. It's kind of fun. There's lots of things that you can do. Get your kids to do it, your next-door neighbor. Because if we're not educating ourselves and being part of the solution, we won't get the solution, and we'll get things like 40-foot sea rise. And if you live in Richmond, sell now, if that's where you think things are going to go. So thanks very much, and I'm glad now to entertain questions. Both of them? Three? Great, yes.
I had the article of Robin Reserve at the Atomic Energy Institute. You state that the nuclear power plant also should be closed, and didn't explain what that has to do with carbon dioxide.
Good. A question about nuclear. Why, in our assessments, have we not suggested that nuclear is part of the solution? The main reason being they simply aren't cost competitive. Wind now you can produce at about 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Not a single gram, not a single liter, not a single pound, not a single kilogram, none of the waste that has been produced by our 14 operating CANDUs in Canada has ever been properly handled or disposed of. So that one's being pushed off as an intergenerational cost. And the other issue is, of course, I won't spend too much time on CANDUs. The reality is, if we're going to get the kinds of renewable energies that we need into the developed and the developing world, it's got to be the lower cost wind, solar options. Thinking of getting nuclear reactors all over the world to deal with climate change, too expensive, too capital intensive. And if you haven't read Keeping in Cats, read that. You can read it online. Wonderful published document on why nuclear just won't make it. Well, the question is regarding wind energy in Germany. Germany has done a fabulous job. They're now over 12% of their electrical requirements are coming from wind. They produce some fabulous technologies. Wind is the fastest growing source of new energy in the world. The reason for the delay in Canada is basically weak knees. There's only two really big sites at the moment. One is in Quebec, 100 megawatts, and there's almost 200 megawatts installed now in Alberta at Cowley Ridge and at Pincher Creek. The Alberta sites this year, well, during 2003, are cost competitive with natural gas turbine electricity. So they finally sort of come head to head. And I think as we see more spikes in the price of natural gas, more and more wind will start to be seen on the Canadian scene. You have to keep in mind, though, about 61% of our electricity in Canada comes from hydro. So we're not likely to see more than 20 or 30% of our energy over the next 20 or 30 years come from wind. But certainly in BC, there are many sites on the west coast of Vancouver Island. There are good sites in Heckett Strait. A very significant amount of our energy should come from wind. Denmark, for example, is now 20%, and the cultures of Europe are just much more tuned into going and implementing things. Almost all of that energy is owned by co-ops. Groups of people like us in Denmark would meet in a hall like this, and everybody would say, "What are your energy bills?" And people would say, "It's around $1,000 a year." And there's 300 of us here. We'd say, "Okay, $300,000. We're going to go ahead and we're going to put in a 1 megawatt unit, and you know, then we own the power." And after we've paid it off after 10 years, we get basically free power. I mean, the Danes are smart, and they're culturally tuned into this kind of thing. So they are in the Netherlands. In Europe now, there's about 3 million people getting pure green power. And this really is the challenge of our time, is to see whether or not we can mobilize ourselves to go right past oil, go right past big oil, go right past our governments. And as people say, we want renewable green power, and if you won't do it for us, we'll do it. Just get out of the way. I think the mood is real in Canada to go renewable. Well, the science suggests, I mean, we are starting to see some of the kinds of climate and weather extremes that are extremely harmful to species and are extremely harmful to our economy. In terms of there being some kind of a flip, I know stuff is being written about it. Certainly from the scientists I've been working with, I'm not worried about a flip. I'm more concerned in getting people mobilized to get us off fossil fuels, which is a pretty big challenge in itself. I saw a hand over here. Yes?
You have indicated that profound, much higher energy efficiency can be obtained for a mere $1,000 per vehicle. If it were that simple, then there are lots of entrepreneurs who would buy Ford or GM or whoever or Honda's car, and if it could be converted for $1,000 and get significant improvement, they would have done it.
Well, if you want, you can go to our website and just read what the Union of Concerned Scientists did for $1,000. I was pleased to see that simply by shifting some carburation and making a very small number of modifications to a brand new, and it was to one of the big ones, to a Ford Explorer, they got really significant increases in mileage and reductions in particulate matter. I think the reality is most people, if they buy one of those big new cars, they're not going to drive it down to a local garage and say, hey, tamper with it. That's just how warranties and all these things work. But I think the Prius is an example of what's actually coming out. And it's the price differential that's still the shock barrier. It's interesting, though, that George Bush will give you $2,000 U.S. if you buy a Prius. But here in B.C. and in Canada, no. Yes. A very good question about population, and the question is in relation to population with the continuing enormous increase in global population. Aren't there things that we should all be doing to try to get a greater degree of education, particularly institutions that are promoting procreation? I've always been concerned about the issue of population, and I think we all have to just find whatever mechanisms we can, because I know certainly I see John Friesen sitting here, who spent most of his life teaching adult education and getting information out all over the world about how to deal with population and how to get families to be smaller. But it's gigantic. It's right there. It's as big as any. Yes. I know Paul Martin very well. I actually spent 4 years on the Environment Committee with him. I went to the Earth Summit in Rio. I attended all of the preliminary meetings to the Rio meeting and the follow-ups to Canada's position on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. He's very knowledgeable on the environmental file, and I think he probably will be and is at the moment the greenest Prime Minister that Canada's ever had. As to how far he's going to go on fossil fuels, he told me to my face 48 hours ago that he's not going to take on the tar sands issue. He's sort of handing that off to others of us. But he did say to David Suzuki and I that he will go further than either of us might expect on atmospheric, water, and ecosystem issues. So we're certainly going to hold his feet to the fire should he get elected with a majority government, which looks quite possible for May. I'll come back over there and I'll just go up to there. That's a very good question. I think everybody heard it in terms of... Oh, the question is in terms of connecting grants between different areas of specialization, so that where there are major issues, major problems, where there can be connectivity, and people are working in that area, that the grants could in some way be connected to attract people to do more work in this area. I'm going to pass that one off because we're over time to Hector or to Daniel, because it's an area I don't know a huge amount about. But thank you all very much. I'm passing it over to the chair. I know there's going to be coffee and cookies and things, and I'd be glad to talk to people when we go out into the foyer.
I'd like to thank Dr. Daniel Pauly, the new director of UBC's Center for Fisheries, to thank our speaker tonight, and to remind you that because of midterm break, there'll be no Vancouver Institute meeting next Saturday, and you should all be out on Valentine's Day dinners anyway. And in 2 weeks from now, we'll be hearing Professor Ira Nadell from UBC's Department of English on Ezra Pound. Sir?
Excuse me.
Sorry, the 21st, Dr. Jeffrey Kurland, my own medicine, a doctor's life as patient. So, Nadell is on the 28th.
I will be thanking Jim Fulton on my behalf and on your behalf as well. But if you think about it, we shouldn't have to, because these numbers that he threw at our face, we should all grow up with them. We should know them, because if we don't act on them, we'll be in deep trouble. And I'll go back to gloom just for a second. We had a blizzard of numbers thrown at us. I'll pick two. One you have heard, and another one that will be my contribution. You ask, what does UBC do? One of the numbers was the pH of the ocean is declining. So the ocean is getting a bit more acidic. Big deal. I mean, it's not going to be as acidic as, say, Coca-Cola or something. It's not going to be such that it will dissolve your hand if you put your hand in it. But what it means is that shelled animals and corals will have problem depositing calcium carbonate. They will not be able to form skeletons very easily. Now, the geologists have mapped this process of increasing or decreasing pH and decreasing inability or increasing inability to form calcium carbonate skeleton. And basically, you can see a pocket of ability of coral reef formation closing. And in 2060, there will be no reef formation, no net reef formation throughout the world. And these are not, this is irrespective of what we do to reefs in terms of drowning them because sea level rise, blasting them because of overfishing, or all these other things. Purely on the basis of chemistry, the changing water chemistry, reefs will cease to exist as entities about 60 years down the line. That's just one number. Another one that, and that's going to be the Fishery Center contribution to the evening, it's a paper that we will submit to one of the big journals that was completed today, actually, and it estimated the amount of carbon dioxide of greenhouse gases that are thrown into the air by fishing fleets. Remember, fishing fleets, there are too many of them, right? There are too many boats, about 4 or 5 times too many, to catch what the sea can give us. Now, you do know, perhaps, that fuel for fishing fleet is subsidized. In other words, they can burn more than they really need because we use taxpayers' money to subsidize that. Fishing fleet throughout the world contribute about 1.5%. Of the world's carbon dioxide emission. That, you would say, that's not much, 1.5%, but it's just one sector. One little sector in which we invest a lot to burn more fuel than we need to. It's one sector that where we could save a huge amount because we could catch the same amount of fish with far less boats. So these are two numbers that I just kind of elaborated on. He has told us, 300 numbers tonight? We will not remember them. But basically, what he has told us, and for this we thank him, what he has reminded us of, is that many of the decisions about species loss have already been taken. we will lose thousands and thousands of species in the next decades. The only question that we have to answer still is whether this planet is going to remain inhabitable for one of the species here, and that's going to be Homo sapiens. Because in the next decades, what we will have to decide is whether this nonsense is going to accelerate or decline. Now, we have seen solutions about how this could decline quite easily, at no real sacrifice for us. But if we don't do it, then scientists can give you scenarios such as runaway greenhouse effect with release of all the methanes in the methane hydrates and in a tundra. And then we get into a Venusian-type atmosphere, where just a few people, I guess Bush and company, can hide in the Rockies and the rest of us will be fried. And that is a few generations down the line. So it's this. I think humanity has never faced a challenge parallel to that. Perhaps the Nazis 50 years ago that had to be faced down. But this was kind of a regional problem, maybe. But now it's the entire planet that is at stake. This is the significance of the numbers that Jim has been talking about. So thank you very much for reminding us of what we should be thinking about. Thank you.